Possible in part by Cranard Center for the Performing Arts, welcoming the Australian Chamber Orchestra and special guest soprano Dawn Upshaw for a concert of music by Bach, Corelli, Szymanowski, and Hungarian folk songs on April 24th. For more information, contact the Cranard Center ticket office at 217-333-6280 or visit CranardCenter.com. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods, featuring foods from Russia, South America, Mexico, and Britain, and featuring food tastings every Saturday from 11 to 5. World Harvest Foods, at the intersection of 6th and University Avenue in Champaign, encourages you to join them in supporting public radio.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. Good afternoon. Thanks for joining us this afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Today, in this portion of the program, we take a look at the life and history of a city by taking a look at one of its most infamous denizens, the rat. Writer Robert Sullivan spent a year observing rats in an alley, Eden's Alley, in New York City, a couple of blocks from Wall Street. He is the author of Rats, Observations on the History and Habitat of the City's Most Unwanted Inhabitants. In the book, Sullivan says, in New York City, the bulk of rats live in quiet desperation, hiding beneath the table of man, under stress, skittering in fear, under siege by larger rats. Which brings me to my experiment. I went to the rat-filled alley to see the life of a rat in the city, to describe its habits and its habitat, to know a little bit about the place where it makes its home and its relationship to the very nearby people. To know the rat is to know its habitat, and to know the habitat of the rat is to know the city. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion with your questions and comments this afternoon. I look forward to your phone calls. Here are the numbers in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Robert Sullivan is the author of two New York Times notable books, The Meadowlands and Whale Hunt. He's a contributing editor to Vogue and a frequent contributor to The New Yorker. His new book, his third, Rats, Observations on the History and Habitat of the City's Most Unwanted Inhabitants, is published by Bloomsbury. Robert Sullivan joins us from Chicago, where this evening, April 14th, 2004, he will appear at Barbara's Books on South Halsted at 7:30. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Robert Sullivan, thanks for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you for having me.
Hey, what sparked your interest in rats to begin with?
I tend to like to write about people, places, and things that maybe nobody else wants to bother with, or maybe places especially that people find disgusting. And it turns out that rats are kind of like the theme park mascot for places that are particularly disgusting.
Yeah, but everybody has a story.
Everybody's got a rat story. Rats are the kind of the lowest, I don't want to say common denominator. Well, I guess, yeah, they're kind of the lowest common denominator in the city. I mean, everybody knows, everybody's seen a rat. I mean, most everybody's seen a rat. And some people have just the greatest rat stories you've ever heard. I mean, and all of them are sort of based on the fact that they can't believe they're with a rat. So, yeah, I get strangely excited about rats.
Yeah.
But I want to emphasize, though, if I may,
yeah,
I find them disgusting. I find them very disgusting. You know, horrible, gross, vile, all those things.
Yeah, yeah. Now, what kind of rat stories are you hearing in Chicago?
Oh, in Chicago? In Chicago, they have some, I mean, historically, as far as the study of rats goes, there were some great studies in the 60s and 70s about rats and rat poison, and so people went through all the alleys in Chicago to look for rats, and they found, in the late 70s, I think, some of the first rats that were resistant to poison. In other words, rats that could eat poison and live and survive, and even, in some cases, thrive on the grain that had the poison in it. So that, to me, is kind of a right there, that, you know, it's like coming to Rome and hearing about the Colosseum or something like this.
Yeah, well, these rats, the brown rat, the Norwegian rat, that's one very tough city dweller.
the toughest.
Yeah.
The toughest. And that's, and you know, they survive exactly where we live. They're like our mirror species. And they just, you know, no matter what we do to them, we come after them with all this technology and all, you know, all the strength of our, you know, the legions of exterminators that we set after them, and yet they survive. I mean, I really thought that I was going to see this most urban thing, but in fact, I feel like I'm writing that high school essay that you had to write about Hawthorne or Poe, where the teacher said, describe man versus nature in the following story. And really, it's not about man versus nature. There's no battle. It's all, if you look at the rat, you realize that one thing isn't natural, one thing's not natural. The whole thing is everything. It's ratty. It's ratty. It's good. It's low. Anyway, I'm crazy, but that's what I think. So,
now, how was it that you began to realize or to think about this? That by looking at the life of rats in cities, you could better know cities. You could maybe even better know humanity.
The thing about rats is that they herd and they mass and they come in crowds. I don't know. There's this line from Whitman that I kept thinking of in Brooklyn, in the crossing the Brooklyn Ferry. He talks about, I am one of a crowd. I was one of the crowd. I'm like you. And here's the thing. You sit in an alley and you watch rats go in and out of the alley. You watch them get up in their morning, which in the mirror world they live in, the opposite world they live in, is our night. They come up at dusk. They walk down the alley as if on cue. They feed. They go in and take a break as if on lunch break, as if after lunch break. They come out again one more time, and then they go to bed, which is in their rat hole, which is not a bed, but a so-called rat hole. And then you see them kind of all freak out when they all come out of the hole together. You see them massing, and then single filing down into one hole in the ground. I've seen all these things, and then I get on a highway and come from the airport in Chicago and watch as people mass on the highways, and one person tries to cut the other person off, and what are you doing? And you start to feel that there's this great animalistic thing. You start to see the way people come together, not a good way, not good, not bad, but the way people come together when you look at rats, believe it or not. And I don't mean to offend, of course, any of the people out there or the rats out there.
Yeah. Boy, it is a rat race, though.
It is a rat race, but that's not a bad thing. That's the thing. Accidentally, what I ended up seeing in the rat alley was history. I have this idea that rats have some sense of history. If you talk to exterminators, if you talk to pest control operators, they'll all tell you that if you take the walls down of the alley, or if there's a rat infestation in a building and you knock the walls down, the rats would get up the next day or night and walk the same path or scurry the same path for the food, even though the walls aren't there, because they use muscle memory. They go to the same paths over and over again. And when I went to this little alley in New York City that's like right near Wall Street, right where the World Trade Center was, right near the ocean, in the oldest part of New York City, and when I was just, you know, this morning out in Chicago looking in an alley and seeing evidence of an excellent rodent infestation, and of course when I say excellent, I mean disgusting, but in this most forgotten place in New York City, for instance, really what I ended up seeing was the history of that place, which seems insignificant, but it turned out, and I have this theory that you can look at any place, almost in the world, but definitely in a city, because there's been so many people there for so many years in every city. But you can look at any place and find that something incredible happened there. And in the case of my totally forgotten little rat alley, Eden's Alley, I discovered accidentally one night that the first battle of the Revolution, of the American Revolution, a battle that is not written about sometimes at all, but definitely not extensively, the first battle of the Revolution occurred in what was my rat alley before it was my rat alley, on this hill in New York City, and in fact, it inspired the Boston Massacre. It inspired the British soldiers to shoot, colonists. That this battle, though, is considered kind of, you know, not worth writing about because it wasn't soldiers, it wasn't George Washington, it wasn't regal personnel. It was a kind of bunch of semi-unemployed sailmakers and sailors and oystermen, and they were considered and referred to as by New York City, the people in charge of the city in colonial times. They were referred to as vermin, as like reptiles, and even as rats. So in the city, you're part of the crowd, and that seems like sometimes a bad thing, but it's also a really good thing, especially when your team in the baseball park makes the home run.
Hmm. Early in the book, in this book, Rats, you mention a painting that you ran across by John James Audubon. And I, too, have seen an Audubon painting of rats, a group of rats among some melons.
Yes. Oh,
did,
yes.
Did he do many of these paintings?
He did. I don't know exactly how many rat paintings he did. I've wondered about that. But I know that he went to the mayor of New York in the 1850s, I believe it was, and he was interested in rats. I didn't know that he was a New Yorker, frankly. I think of him as a guy all around the country. But in fact, at the end of his life, he ended up being in New York. And he became convinced that there was another species of rat, a previously unidentified species of rat. But of course, at the time, everybody was trying to sort of classify, you know, use taxonomy to classify everything. And naturalists were, you know, running each other over to, you know, to outclassify the other guy, to find a new species or to identify a variant. He thought that he saw a different kind of rat in the harbors, in the ports on the East Coast. And he wrote the mayor at the time a letter and asked if it would be okay. And again, this is our sort of one of our most revered naturalists, so I was inspired by this. But he wrote the mayor of New York at the time a letter and said, would it be all right if I shot rats, which is what he did with birds, of course. He shot them and then painted them. But would it be all right if I shot rats down on the Battery, down in the lowest part of Manhattan? And the mayor said, fine, as long as you don't do it, when there are any people around, please do it, you know, early in the morning or late at night. And he did that, and then he started painting rats. But that was when he started to get old, and he went blind, and it was sort of at the end of his career. Mm-hmm. But when I went to go see where he lived, because, again, I was amazed mm-hmm. that he was a city guy in the end, when I went to go see where he lived, it's up in Washington Heights in New York City. And Washington Heights is right, there's an avenue up there called Audubon Avenue, and I saw his grave in the old cemetery. It's got this beautiful, amazing Celtic cross, covered, by the way, with pictures of mammals. But anyway, when I saw his grave, I went to Audubon Avenue, and I almost exactly figured out where his house was. And sure enough, there was a huge abandoned lot there, one of the last abandoned lots in the area, that was totally infested with rats. So I took this as a sign from the naturalist gods. But a great coincidence, I think a great historical coincidence, is the fact that in where Audubon used to live, his land, is now this neighborhood called Washington Heights. And Audubon was born in the Dominican Republic, on the island that is the island where the Dominican Republic is. And his father was a French captain, and he had this child with this Dominican woman who lived in the island of Dominican Republic, and that is who Audubon is. And anyway, the neighborhood where Audubon's house is now a neighborhood full of people from the Dominican Republic. So I feel like there's some kind of great accidental closure there.
Yeah. Well, do we know how Audubon felt about rats? I mean, the paintings are
great.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, he obviously thought they were fascinating.
Yeah.
I think it's a mistake not to think that a lot of stuff is fascinating. You know, a lot of stuff that's in the category of not worrying about or noticing.
Yeah. Well, you know, in India, there's a shrine dedicated to the rat.
Yeah, in India, the rat that you see in the cities a lot, is, I think, as best I recall, I have not been to India, but it's the bandicoot rat. The bandicoot rat. And the bandicoot rat, he gets kind of a better treatment. The rat in India gets a much better treatment. And you see them in the cities. I've seen video. I've seen pictures. And they're in the cities, and they're treated a little bit more like squirrels. And there's something. If you sit in an alley with rats for a long time, and I know there's somebody in the Chicago area who's doing a study on squirrels. There aren't many studies on squirrels. There was a study I read in the 20s called "Why Do Squirrels Bury Their Nuts?" And I think that's a great question, because it turns out they don't remember where they bury them, which is, of course, why I can relate to squirrels. But if you sit in an alley and watch rats for long enough, then you go home and, you know, you go out late and you say goodnight to the kids and you go out watching rats, and then you come home and go to bed late and get up early in the morning. And so, granted, you're a little bit tired, you're a little exhausted, you're maybe even more insane. But when you get out in the day and everybody's feeding squirrels and enjoying squirrels, you kind of have a whole other take on squirrels. You just want to shake everybody and say, hey, wait a minute. You know what? Squirrels are really, well, yeah, I think you know what I'm saying.
They're rodents.
Yeah, no offense again to squirrels or to rodents.
Yeah, but they're cute rodents.
Because of the tail? Is that why?
I think so.
I think so, and the tail on the rat certainly is, I think, unless you're turning the rat over and looking at its teeth, which are absolutely really scary, unless you're doing that, then the keynote feature of the rat, it seems to me, is the tail. And if you see a rat in an alley, you can see him like, you know, I've taken videotape, sadly, with my friend from high school's video camera. He originally, he was just trying to find a subject to practice on, because his wife was about to have a baby, and he wanted to be ready to take some good shots. So we practiced on rats. And anyway, I've taken video in the alley, and you see the rats, you know, really muscularly throwing themselves with each step across an alley or across cobblestones and skittering and left, right, turning as they bolt around. You can't believe the physical moves they make, but the tail, as if controlled by gyroscopes or unseen liquid, the tail stays perfectly straight, perfectly at attention. It's like something off of a Ferrari or some Italian-designed car. It's oddly beautiful.
The rat tail comb.
There you go.
One of the exterminators you met along the way in this journey, in this adventure, is a man by the name of Larry Adams.
Yes.
And he told you the rats you see in the alleyways of a city, you're just seeing the tip of the tail.
Yes.
So what's going on down below?
Yes. Below, for me, is the reason. I mean, below, the city is above and below. Another crazy idea I have is that if you dig, you go into the past. This seems like a long way to get about to answering a question about Larry Adams, the city's New York City's eldest and coolest, one of their coolest exterminators. But if you dig, you go into the past. Once I went to Rome, and I went to this church. San Clemente is the name of the church. It's over by the Colosseum. And it's, I think, a medieval church built on top of an early Christian church, built on top of a Mithraeum, or that is a temple, or sort of a small temple to the god Mithras, the cult of Mithras, which involved a bull and slaying a bull. And then that is itself, that temple, is built on the home of a Roman nobleman who had a nice spot by a creek. And the creek still runs as a sewer in the basement of this triple, almost quadruple-layered church. And so as you go down into the church, you go into Rome's past. And in the same way, as you go down into New York City or Chicago or any place, you know, the way it works, you go, even just geologically speaking, you go into the past. And so two things are happening to me when Larry says that. And one is that, yes, because we don't even realize the history that we live on and in, and we don't know how we're just sort of animalistically doing what our ancestors have done. They've walked down these streets and traveled these paths, maybe first by horse and then or walked them, and now by congested highway. But so that's the first thing. Sort of, yeah, we don't know the tip of what rats might tell us if we were all stupid enough to sit in alleys watching them. But the other thing he says speaks to just kind of the physical rat problem, which it's always called throughout the ages, the rat problem. And the new frontier, I think, I would argue, in rat studies by people looking to control rats is the sewers. There's this idea now that, with poisons, and you probably see these poison bait stations around your city, around every city, around suburban backyards, everywhere, where there are little black boxes with holes on either end, and they hold poison inside them. And rats love to go into them because they're like little rat day spas. They're perfectly engineered inside such that the rat is completely relaxed and happy, and there's like a little, wet bar, but instead of alcohol, there's poison. So it's just a really smartly designed thing for the smart rat, except that the rat eats the poison and eventually dies. So mostly what we do is concentrate on the top of our cities, and we just kill rats. And the new frontier in rat control is all about the sewers, because people really don't seem to understand how many rats live in sewers. And there's a guy up in Boston whose name is Bruce Colvin, and he studied this a lot because he looked at rats underground when they were moving the highway in Boston. It's referred to as the Big Dig.
Mm-hmm.
The Big Dig in Boston, this guy smartly got in and got to check out what was going to happen to rats when they dug up, half the city. And he studied rats underground, rats in sewers. And it turns out they live differently in older sewers and newer sewers. But anyway, there's this idea that if you don't go after rats underground, then by killing them on top of the ground, you are, as was said to me by Bobby Corrigan, a guy who I think is a really amazing rat mind, you are just, it's like harvesting corn. They just keep coming up from the ground, and you're cutting off the very small top. So, I just walked down an alley here in Chicago, and it looked like, they had all these poison bait traps out to try to kill the rats, but then I saw the holes. Saw the holes where they were coming up through these old sewer openings, and kill away. But if you don't know what's underneath you, if you don't, then you don't really know the city.
Yeah.
I think, I don't know, I'm crazy, though. You've already done that, I'm sure you've, I would say put down the phone, walk away anyway.
A man passionate about rats. Robert Sullivan. Our guest this afternoon, his latest book is Rats: Observations on the History and Habitat of the City's Most Unwanted Inhabitants. He says that by taking a look at the rat and how it lives and its history in a city, you can get a pretty good look at the life and history of our cities and how we live in them as human beings. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with your questions. Comments also invited. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. Anywhere else, toll-free 800-222-9455. Robert Sullivan is joining us this afternoon from Chicago, where this evening, April 14th, 2004, he'll appear at Barbara's Books on South Halsted at 7:30.
I'm hoping people think that I'm saying cats, and that, if it's cats, maybe somebody would actually come. If it's rats, you always worry that just scare people. But.
Yeah. Well, it's pretty interesting. I wonder I think that one of the most interesting things of this book is the history aspect of it, and to as you suggested a moment ago, to climb down into the city, down below, the layers, and look at the history of the city. And one of the things that was fascinating to learn is, you know, the history of Eden's Alley, and also that Times Square was once a farm.
Oh, yeah.
And that also, I think this is in your book, that our streets and alleyways today, you know, we took up, when we entered the scene, we walk, we drive, we get along, along pathways that are now streets and alleyways, but once were routes taken by animals.
Yeah. Oh, I love that. I love that notion for some strange reason. The other day, now I just moved out of the city. I moved from Brooklyn up the Hudson River, and with my daughter, we walked to school through some woods, and there was a fresh snow, and you notice that when you're taking a new path, invariably your path follows the deer's path. The deer and the humans, if one of them is thinking and one of them is not thinking, I think I'm like the humans not thinking, you end up you walk the same way because it's the obvious way to walk for whatever reason. It's along a stream or it's at the edge of a hill. We forget how much geography and topography matters to us. It still matters. And even if you turn on CNN during a war when, you know, you find when there's limited resources and there's a rodent infestation, sure enough, the rodents, the rats, start killing each other and going after each other and fighting for those limited resources and saying, well, I want that, what you have, and so, you know, I'm going to go after you. And if you turn on CNN during a war, or, you know, if you listen to all those generals pointing at, or watch them point at maps and so forth, you see that yeah, we have, you know, all these amazing planes and radar and, you know, all this stuff, and we think that war is, you know, I don't know what we think. But it turns out that no matter how many billions of dollars of hardware you have, they still have to, like, get by the hill or take the hill or get down into the river valley. I mean, it's amazing in so many ways, even in those the most extreme example of war, but also in the in the absolute mundane example of going to work. There's something to do with geography in your decision.
Mm. Tell us about the jacket for the book done by Peter Cease. Marvelous illustration.
Oh, thank you very much.
And here we have, an illustration that is illustrates beautifully what we've been talking about.
Well, I think it was my daughter's idea. She's about 8, and she has very good taste in artists. And then I wrote him a note because he did a poster, or he did an illustration that ended up as a poster in the New York City subway system that was of a whale, and the whale was a grid of the city, and it just kind of made sense. City, animal, people, map, chart, topography, geography, all those things smashed into one elegant smashment. Of course, when you have a cover like that, you're a little concerned, if you're me especially, that as I say, that people, you know, will judge the book by the cover and then buy it and then race to return it because the book's not as good as the cover. But I'm willing to take that chance, mostly because I just think it's so cool, the cover. Yeah, he's amazing. And he has these great books, Madlenka. There are stories about this girl, Madlenka, and her neighborhood. And that's really what my daughter was talking to me about and what I was trying to write about, which is kind of looking into the secret places in your neighborhood. Or conversely, how the places in your neighborhood can feel secret to you and special to you. Mm. I mean, that's the great thing about cities. But, you know, I mean, there's a lot, rats have a lot to do with sort of farms in the country, too, because there are people there. Wherever there are people, there are rats. But that's the other great thing about cities is that you can feel lonely in a city, but you can also feel special and really individualistic in a city. I mean, cities highlight both those things. You can feel part of the mob. You know, I've been in parades where I thought, oh my God, I'm part of a mob and somebody's going to get hurt. But, you know, you can also be so happy that you've run into somebody on, you know, Michigan Avenue. Or, you know, in my case, on one of the nights I went to go rat trapping, actually on September 10th, 2001, I went to go rat trapping, and I was with my friend Dave from high school, and we ran into another guy from high school we hadn't seen in years. But how do you run into somebody in a city of 8 million people? How do you do that? And that's because, like rats, we run our same courses, our same circles. Even though we feel like we're far away, we're in our kind of special places that are at the same time not special, but then again are special.
Hmm. Do people in rural settings view rats differently than people in urban settings?
Well, I can say that. Interestingly to me, that probably kills it for everybody else, but to me it's interesting that city rats grow bigger, generally speaking. The studies I've read say bigger than country rats. However, country rats can live longer, closer to 2 years. A city rat, and I'm talking about brown rats or Norway rats, misnamed, by the way, they probably came from Denmark to England, to where the guy who named them was living. But city rats will only live about a year, and country rats can live maybe two years. They're the same. Brown rats are also called gray rats, also called field rats, also called farm rats, also called river rats, also called city rats. It's all the same. And you know, they might be eating crops. They might be living under chicken raising sheds, not being too good a farm person. I don't know the terminology, but they're all the same. And when I moved out of Brooklyn last year, I moved up the river a little bit, and everybody, a couple of people I know, okay, one person said to me, you know, you're going to love this place. We have lots of rats. And I said, huh? And they said, yeah, we have river rats. Because they knew I was trying to type up this book. And we have rats because of the river, they said. And I said, no. You don't have rats because of the river. You don't have rats. You can't call them field rats. They're not rats because of the field. They're rats because you're there. They are there because humans are there. They are, you know, like dogs, they've figured out that that's a good place to live. When we're done with our food, they'll pick it up. They'll just start right in. When we're done with our day, they come out.
Do rats live where there are no people?
No, they don't. There's different kinds of rats that live where there are no people, but not
this one.
Not brown rats and Norway rats. In fact, there was this study around 19. It was in the teens. No, wait, I take it back. There's a better study that happened around World War II. It was after World War II, late 40s, 48, 49. And it was in the South Pacific. And they found a colony of Norway rats that they thought might be and I have trouble with the term wild now, like natural, but they thought it might be a wild colony of Norway rats. But when they looked into it, they found out that there had been, until a few years before, a Japanese concentration camp there. And in fact, that was the garbage area that the Japanese concentration camp had. That's where the rats were living. And they were surviving on the remnants, on what was left over of that, and the stuff that had grown up from that. So there again, the rats indicated this history in that place.
Yeah. There's a footnote in your book as well about rats. I don't know if it was New Zealand proper, but there in the South Pacific.
Oh, it was an island,
yeah.
Campbell Island.
Yeah.
That's, I think, you know, considered New Zealand land.
Yeah. So anywhere we go, they will follow.
Yeah. Well, that's because the story there, they say, is that Captain Cook brought those rats there. So, yeah, and they infested the island. When they multiplied, they ended up killing some endangered birds. So people decided that they would get rid of the rats. I think the government of New Zealand decided to get rid of the rats by bringing a huge amount of pesticide to the island and dropping all this rodenticide on the island and trying to do it in a way such that it wouldn't hurt anything else. But there was an accidental pesticide spill from a barge, and now it's gotten into some of the shellfish in the area. But they killed off the rats, and so now they're going to try to reintroduce, I think it was a kind of teal, a kind of bird or duck. I don't know, would there ever be a point where, this is why rats are the line in the species that we care about, sand. Will anybody try then to get rid of the teal and reintroduce the rats? No, that wouldn't happen, right?
Right.
Hmm. I'm not saying you'd want to. Did I already mention that I think rats are disgusting? I want to make that very clear.
Yeah. Vile, great word.
Vile is a good word, isn't it?
To describe them. Let's talk with a listener. Caller on the toll-free line in Danville. Hi.
Good afternoon. I had planned to eat lunch and listen to the show, but the best I can do is tea, and maybe around 3 I'll try it again. But, you know, I enjoy this man, really. I think he ought to take this monologue on the road. You know, we've lost Spalding Gray, but I think he can take his place.
Oh, well, thank you. I know I can't take Spalding Gray's place, that's for sure.
I don't know. You can work on it, you know.
Well, maybe. I am on the road. We're at home at my house with the kids. We're calling it the Rats Over America Tour. Of course, it should be the Rats Under America Tour, but, you know, it's small detail.
Yeah. Well, what I wanted to ask you about was this. When you're out there violating their domain, do they ever attack you?
No, I mean,
really?
Not so far. There's some amazing stories about rat attacks, and people are bitten by rats. And you know, something that's amazing about the rat is, if you look at it, you can kind of figure out about history. Also, if you look at rat bites in a city, for instance, reports of rat bites, that rats are an indication of, for me, a neighborhood that probably needs people to care about it more. Whether that means, you know, landlords aren't caring about buildings, or the city needs to get money into that neighborhood, or whatever. It's just, rats are also an indicator of care need,
mm-hmm.
I think. But so there's rat bites, and usually a lot of the rat bites occur. Rats tend to bite children because oftentimes children go to bed with food still on their face,
mm-hmm.
and the rat is able to sadly bite the child. But there's an amazing story in New York City about a woman in 1979 who was attacked, so many bystanders said, by a herd of, you know, a bunch of rats, and they were crawling up on her and crawling in the car, and she got in the car and she was screaming and she ran and she drove off and the rats were on the car. But the police never found anyone who reported into the hospitals. Still, there were numerous bystanders who saw this. And I talked to the exterminators who killed hundreds of rats in an abandoned lot right where she was.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, this I found them after this. You know, they're still working in the 70s. The guy we mentioned, Larry Adams, he was one of them. But I was once in an alley, and then I'll stop talking about rats attacking people because really, you know, you need to eat lunch at some point today. But but I was in an alley with my friend Dave from high school and. Also, my friend Matt, and he and we were standing there, and there was a guy who knew a lot about the rats in that alley. This was another alley. And he started saying, and he was kind of living on the street, and unfortunately he was, he was sort of too close to the rats. But anyway, he starts banging the cans and getting the rats to come out of their three nests, and they all start coming out, and they're all, oh my God, they're all coming towards us. And we weren't drinking, so we tried to sanely calculate the number of rats, and we know that it was more than 100, probably like 101 or 102, but it was, you know, it was a lot of rats, and they're all coming towards us, and we're in an alley, and this was a moment that was quite upsetting. It was, I felt like we stood closer together in those few seconds, and I had this picture of us kind of at the stake being ready to be burned, but that's how we were standing physically. And anyway, they're coming all towards us, and they're freaking out. And that's the thing you have to remember about rats. When they're coming towards you like that, you're saying, oh, my God, there's a rat coming toward me, or the variation, oh, my God, there's a herd of rats coming towards me. But chances are, if the rats could say anything, and I'm sort of glad they can't, they're probably saying something to the effect of, oh, my God, there's a bunch of people in the alley, oh, my God. So they're all coming at us straight, and I'm wrapping this up, I swear, but they're all coming at us in this mass, and then just as they came to this corner in the alley where there was an abandoned lot where they were living down in these brick and holes and bricks, and they all took a left, and they went from being this, you know, 5, 6, 7 lane mass, and when they hit the corner, they all went single file down into the hole. And it just reminded me of, you know, being in Washington, D.C., for instance, and everybody coming at rush hour and getting right onto the escalator, single file, to go down into the metro.
Uh-huh. Oh, gosh.
So,
oh, man.
I hope someday you'll eat again.
No, I was just thinking, God, and you didn't, no one ran?
We didn't run because we were too terrified.
I've never been that scared in my life.
Well, I'm sure there are people out there who've seen more rats than me, unfortunately, but I'm one of the most cowardly people you'd meet, so if I could handle it, somebody else could have, I'm sure.
Well, I run from noises, anything. I don't actually have to see anything, but, well, you're a braver man than I.
Well, thank you.
And appreciate speaking to you. Bye.
Bye.
Bye. I guess one of the things, too, is if you're faced with that situation, the best thing to do is remain calm.
Yeah, calm is, yeah. So that's what they think happened with this woman in 79, because all these people were talking about it at the time, saying, what could have happened? Why would rats attack? But, you know, they were near her, and she might have upset this huge colony, and then they sort of thought that she was, because she was probably, as per the eyewitness accounts, freaking out, to use the lay term, and I think that fear, people and things smell fear.
Mm. You met a guy along the way. I think you were referring to him earlier, a man who lived on the street, Derek.
Oh, Derek, he was in the alley that night.
Yeah, and he had kind of an interesting idea about rats, that he saw some social organization, and he described it as, you know, there were elders in the rat pack. Is there a pecking order?
You know, I'd been reading all this literature, especially from the 40s, the late 40s, a lot of stuff written under the auspices of somebody named Dave Davis, who was working with the federal government to look at rats, and because they were worried about food supplies in Europe and with the Marshall Plan and disease being spread and so forth. And anyway, he was an ecologist who said, you know, we've never looked at these city animals, and they're alive too. Anyway, he charted out with other people, Robert Emlyn, all these rat experts. A very small number of rat experts exist and have existed, but they wrote about this, a kind of pecking order, and the large male will attack, you know, this territory is very important. One colony won't go towards the next colony. And I was reading all this stuff, and it seemed, you know, kind of like something in an academic paper. And then when Derek stood there and pointed this out and said, look, this one won't go over there, I mean, he was describing what was in this academic paper from 1948 exactly. Yes, and there's like a line in the middle of an alley where a big rat will walk but won't walk any farther, or if as soon as he does, the other colony's big rat comes out and says, no, 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 you're not coming over here. And you know, I mean, you certainly see that just, for example, in the economy of the United States of America, big rats constantly going after smaller rats and telling them how to go about things.
Do you remember the cartoon Biggie Rat and Itchy Brother?
Oh, man, yeah, I remember. Yep,
yeah.
Exactly.
See? We've got to wrap it up. And I want to thank you.
You said wrap it up?
Wrap it up.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, yeah.
I said, anyway, yeah.
Yeah. we've got to close it up.
Okay.
Everyone back to their nests. Robert, thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon. Really enjoyed it.
Thank you for enduring a rat talk.
Robert Sullivan has been our guest this afternoon in this portion of The Afternoon Magazine. His book is Rats: Observations on the History and Habitat of the City's Most Unwanted Inhabitants. The book is published by Bloomsbury. 9 minutes before 2 o'clock, and settlement prices are in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thank you very much, Celeste. From the Chicago Board of Trade this afternoon, futures bouncing back after 2 days of losses in the corn and the wheat pits today. The corn futures up anywhere between 4 and 5 cents on the day. The wheat futures were up something between 5.5 and 8.25. In fact, that nearby May contract was up 8.25 cents. 4.02 was the high of the day, low at 3.91. Settlement price there at 4.01 and a quarter. It finished once again 8.25 higher. July wheat now, 4.10 and a half, the high, the low at 3.99, settled 4.10, up 7.75 in September futures. 4.15, the high, the low at 4.06. Settlement price 4.14 and a half, up 7.25. December contract in the wheat pit, 4.24, the high, the low at 4.13. Settled 4.23 and a half, up 7.5 cents. In the March futures, 4.25 and a half high, low at 4.17. Settled 4.25 and a half, and they finished the day 5.5 higher. May corn now 3.18, the high, the low at 3.09 and a half. Settlement price 4.75 cents higher, 3.16 and a half. The settlement price for the nearby May. July futures in the corn 3.25, the high, the low at 3.16 and a quarter. Settled 3.24 and a quarter, up 5.75. In September corn 3.23, the high, the low at 3.13 and a half. Settlement price at 3.20 and a half, up 4.75. Now the December contract 3.21. The high, the low at 3.11 and a half, and settlement price at 3.19 and a half, up 5 and a half. May, or rather March contract, 3.23 and a quarter high, low at 3.14. A settlement price at 3.22, up 6 and a quarter. May corn 3.25, the high, the low at 3.16 and a half, settled 3.24, up 5 and 3 quarters. In July futures for 05, 3.25 and a quarter, the high, the low at 3.16 and a half. Next year's July contract settled 5 and 3 quarters higher at 3.24, and December 05 corn 2.81, the high, the low at 2.77 and a half, settled 2.80 and a quarter, up 2 and a quarter. May oats now 1.68, the high, the low at 1.63, a settlement price there at 1.66 and 3 quarters, up 3 and 3 quarters. In July futures, 1.73 and a half, the high, the low at 1.69 and a quarter, settlement price at 1.72 and a half, and they finished 3 and a half higher for the day. From the soy complex, Nile, the nearby May contract at 10.16 high, low at 9.64, a pretty good sized trading range for the day. Settlement price at 10.13. up 41.5 cents on the day. July beans, 10.17, the high, the low at 9.64. Settlement price, 10.14 and a half. They were up 43. August soybeans, 9.57, the high, the low at 9.11. Settlement price at 9.53 and a half, up 35. And September futures, 8.27, the high, the low at 7.98. Settled 8.24 and a half, 21 and a half higher on the day. November contract up 27 and a half cents there, 7.67 for your new crop on the high, the low at 7.30 and a half, settled 7.65 and a half. Once again, that November up 27 and a half cents. I'm sure Paul Cooley of ADM Investor Services will have a lot to say about the market today. You can hear him at 6 after the hour of 2 o'clock Central Time during the closing market report. January beans, 7.62, the high, the low at 7.32. Settlement price there, 7.61, up 23 in the March futures. 7.53, the high, the low at 7.27, settled 7.51 and a half, and they finished 20 cents higher. Bean meal now, 3.23.50, the high, the low at 3.07.30, settled 3.22. They were up 11.70 for the day. July meal, 3.21, the high, the low at 3.04.50, and a settlement price 11.80 higher at 3.19.70. May bean oil, 32.90, the high, the low at 31.55, settlement price in the May bean oil, 32.83, up 1.34, and July futures up 1.35. They had a high today of 32.85, a low at 31.48, and the July bean oil settled 32.78. Once again, that price was up 1.35 for the day. Now here's Celeste Quinn with the numbers from the Chicago Mercantile Exchange.
Higher day today on the Mercantile Exchange. April feeder cattle, 92.50 the high, 92.10 the low, 92.50 the settlement, that up 15. May, 90.55, the high, 89.40, the low, 90.12.5, the settlement, that up 50. August, 91.35, the high, 90.20, the low, 91.10, the settlement, that up 42.5. April live cattle, 85.55, the high, 84.45, the low, 85.10, the settlement, that up 50. June, 79.35, the high, 78.15, the low, 78.52.5, the settlement, that down, 15. August, 78.35, the high, 77.15, the low, 77.72.5, the settlement, that up, 27.5. October, live cattle, 79.07.5, the high, 78.05, the low, 78.92.5, the settlement, that up, 60. April lean hog, 64.65, the high, 64.30, the low, 64.57.5, the settlement, that up 25. May, 68.90, the high, 67.62.5, the low, 68.77.5, the low, the settlement, that up 62.5. June, 75 even, the high, 72.75, the low, 74.80, the settlement, that up 97.5. July lean hogs, the high today, 73.50, the low, 71.67.5, the settlement, 73.45, that up, 87.5. May pork bellies, 104.10, today's high, 101.90, the low, finishing at 103.87.5, up 87.5. The Dow, currently down 39 points at 10,342. The NASDAQ is 10 lower at 2019. The S&P 500 is down 5 points at 1125.
Agricultural information is made possible in part by a grant from the Archer Daniels Midland Company. ADM, the nature of what's to come.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Heather Hutchins from Lawrence, Kansas writes, "Dear Dr. Science, please help me understand the difference between men and women. I'm about to be engaged, and my future husband's behavior often mystifies me. Why do men burp in public?"
Men periodically enter altered states of consciousness where the majority of their attention is focused inwardly, on a spot just above the navel. During this trance state, they seem to be thinking about something, but quite often there's simply no one at home. Often they're chewing, a hypnotic motion not unlike a cow working her cud. From an evolutionary standpoint, this behavior is equivalent to the Aboriginal dream time, where the astral body roams at will. This enabled primitive hunters to locate game at great distances. When the man comes to, he announces his return to this dimension with a loud burp. So take comfort in the fact that your future mate seems well adapted to at least a Neanderthal existence.
Thank you, Dr. Science. Send your science questions to Ask Dr. Science. Remember, he's not a real doctor.
I have a master's degree
in science.
Produced by Duck's Breath. To order the Dr. Science Smug Mug, call 800-989-DUCK.
You're tuned to The Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 WILL Urbana, the broadcasting service of the University of Illinois. Jason Croft is our technical director today, the producer for the show, Harriet Williams.